With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yes, Dan. How are you, mate?
Hey, how's it going? All right?
Yeah. All things considered, things are okay. They could be better, definitely, but they could also be worse. How about you?
Much the same. Much the same, yeah. It's all good, really. Just glad to be alive still.
That's it. A bit of humility and gratitude in times like these gets you through it, doesn't it?
Definitely. Definitely, yeah.
I was trying to remember the last time I saw you, and it's been 4 years. The last time would have been, if I'm correct, at your Darknestival, at the O2 in December 2016. We did a bunch of live Q&As on the stage as part of that, and you kindly let me do a little DJ set opening up for you guys as well. Since then, Dan, you've released two albums, both of which have been amazing. Just incredible stuff. You're living up to your promise of continuing to shit out solid gold.
It's like diarrhea now.
Gold diarrhea, though.
We're very loose.
And you've been doing a lot of producing at your like home studio, right? The Hawk's Nest. Is this where a lot of the magic has been created over the last two records?
Yeah. Well, it's to call it a home studio is probably doing it a bit of a disservice.
A full-on studio, is it?
Yeah. It's the only thing that sets it apart from commercial studios, really, I think, is the fact that I don't rent it out to anyone. So,
yeah.
But basically, it's far enough away from the house that I can pretend I'm at work when I'm not.
So have you been doing a lot of work in there over lockdown? What have you been doing this year? Because this year obviously was meant to be, I guess, like the East is Cancelled world tour, right? You put out that record at the end of last year. Did you have touring pretty much booked up throughout 2020?
Well, we were quite lucky, really. So we only had the American tour left to do, which is,
right.
So we normally there for about 6 to 8 weeks on an album tour. And obviously we had the festivals in the summer, and then that would have been it for us anyway. So we would have disappeared into the studio for pretty much a year. So we managed to do like the UK and Europe and Australia, and then we got cut short before we could do America. And obviously it would have been nice to play the new album songs at the festivals this year, but wasn't meant to be. But it could be a lot worse. I mean, we just went into the studio earlier than we'd planned to.
Right.
And, you know, as far as the band's career goes, I've been saying for a while that we kind of needed to leave the field fallow for a year. I've been saying that for a long time, it's not, everyone thinks now that you have to just keep bombarding people and reminding them that they need to be invested in you and your business, whatever it may be. But I'm a bit more old school now. I think sometimes it's good to have to be away for people to be excited about you coming back. So so it's kind of played right into my hands, really. But unfortunately, but sadly, it hasn't played very well into the hands of our road crew, who it's just really tough. I was just talking to my wife about it. Just so many people I know, kind of literally out there painting fences and signing on, and it's just weird. It's just the rug being pulled firmly from under their feet, and it's not so bad for us because we just switched to going to the studio. We disappear for months at a time anyway,
yep.
And our crew will go and work for other people. You know, that's because they're highly skilled technicians and they can get work the drop of a hat. You know, but the whole profession just disappeared overnight. So it's really tough for them, but not so tough for us.
I was thinking the other day, because when you guys landed on the scene, it seemed, I guess, from the outside looking in, like you just, you know, arrived fully formed as this larger-than-life juggernaut, like rock god sent down to earth from heaven. But obviously the reality was, for quite a while, you were just kind of like honing that stage show. What I would love to know from you, Dan, to kind of get things going and delve a little bit into the history of the Darkness, is when you're playing like the Camden Barfly and these kind of, you know, small venues back in the day when you're starting out, are you playing like the Darkness that we now know even then? Like, was that larger than life delivery of the material and the presentation of it, was that always the way that you guys came out the gate?
Well, there were different incarnations of the band before we were named the Darkness. So we were Empire for a while. But it wasn't, this wasn't that lineup, that original lineup. But when we named ourselves the Darkness and we settled on that final lineup of
you, Justin, Frankie, and Ed, yeah.
But we kind of at that point when we went out to play live, it was pretty obvious that was the agenda, really. You know, like just to kind of be as overblown and in your face and not really care, you know, what people thought. I mean, I'd say yes. I mean, I think we took quite a few months to get it together sonically.
Yeah.
You know, by that I mean, you know, we've all carried loads of kind of different alternative influences into the band, but everyone kind of had to comply with Justin and my format for the band, which was basically just none more rock, you know.
Yeah,
and everything had to rock. Nothing could ever be boring. There couldn't be a dull moment, you know. It's like that kind of thing. So we kind of took us a few gigs to get that together, and that also came about and was developed by having that legendary Saturday night slot at the Monarch, which then turned out to be the Barfly, but back then it was the Monarch. So
I would have loved to have seen you guys around that time. I mean, what a great time.
Do you know what? I've actually got a really good recording of our very first gig.
Wow.
At what turned out to be the Barfly. I would love to share it with people because I just think it's unbelievable. But my brother won't allow it because because it's pretty wild. It's pretty wild because
Is it video, Dan, or is it just audio?
No, sadly, it's from back in the day when if you wanted to take a picture, you'd go and buy a camera from Boots.
Yeah, and it would be plugged into the wall, and you'd only have about a meter's cable.
Exactly, or it'd be disposable, and you take it down the pub with you, and then by the end of the night, you take a load of pictures, and then you leave it on the train on the way home.
Always, yeah. So it's just audio, but you think it stands up, but Justin is.
Yeah, I think it's wild because you can hear him just like. If his falsetto is completely out of control, he's got no control over it at all, but he's still going for it. And it's like you can hear, like in the second song, where he basically takes his top off, you know. And it's like there's only about seven. I remember you can hear how few people are watching us at that point. There's like seven people there, and you can hear them laughing, you know. It's like and that was like second song in, he'd done that, and it's but yeah, so I would say it was pretty fun. But those Saturday night slots, I mean, John Mack, who was the promoter for the Barfly at the time.
He now does Reading, right?
He does, yeah.
Johnny. I know him well. He's a good dude.
Do you? He's a great guy. And a great footballer, actually.
Yeah.
He and I used to play football. The band, it's another thing people probably don't realise, that the band are really into football, and we used to play football every Saturday at Regent's Park. And John and I would be like the centre-backs, because he's pretty tall, and so am I. So we used to lock that stuff down on a Saturday morning, and then by the night time, we'd be rocking out at the Barfly. But yeah, he was the only one that would the book us, basically. I mean, we sent, you know, our demo tapes out to pretty much every London venue, and he was the only one that would book us, and the only slot he could give us, because he just didn't know what to do with us, was the Saturday night slot. And it sounds like that would be a really good slot to have, but that's actually the worst slot for an up and coming band, because
people just want to get pissed, right?
Well, yeah, but the A&R guys and the industry and the scouts, they don't work on weekends. They're not going to go to the Barfly on a Saturday night.
Yeah, because they've been there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like that's just not what you do. So we would be there, and everyone was, but it was great. So we owned that slot, and it kind of went from like 20 people to 30 to 50 to 100 to, you know, to pretty much 150 every Saturday by the end of it, or every time we played there. So and that kind of informed, you know, when we get together for rehearsals during the week, we would see which songs were landing, and we could literally feel when the audience were bored and those songs were gone by the next week, you know, or were adjusted so that there was there were no boring bits. And that's, I think, pretty much why the first album sounds the way it does. Like, it just is like, because we managed to sort of, I hate the word hone. Hone sounds like there's actually some art involved, but it's more.
It was all killer, no filler.
Basically, yeah.
You chopped off all excess fat.
Basically, yeah. It was basically, we were butchers, not artists.
Well, it reminds me, Dan, of, I can't remember whether I heard it or saw it, but it was an interview with Mick and Keith and talking about the early days of the Stones. And they were saying it really was as simple as the first show, there was like two people there. And we just said, well, let's just put on the best show of our lives. So then those two people tell a friend, and next week there'll be four. And they said it literally worked like that. If you just keep doubling the audience, then organically that is going to grow exponentially quite fast. And didn't you guys sell out the Astoria before you even got a record deal?
We did, yes. Yeah. So we oversold it, in fact. It was rammed. They had more people in there than was legally allowed. But it was cool because, we were in there. We didn't have any money for a light show. We just used the in-house lights. You know, there's a smoke machine, and the staging, they had a load of, when we got there to load in, they had a load of kind of like sort of not really staging, but more like tables, I suppose.
Right.
And we kind of put them together and made a drum riser out of that. And then I found a load more. So I put them all together, and they were all like kind of like just wobbling about, but it was almost like this kind of like platform behind the Marshall stacks for Justin to sort of like run around. And so it actually looked like we had a bit of production, but we didn't.
Creative use of the space.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically it's just, so it was very, very, spit and sawdust, but yeah, I'll never forget that night. I couldn't believe that, you know, that there were so many, like headbangers. Like, it was just so many, young blokes with long hair headbanging. I was like, wow, gosh, this is like, it's weird how like the dynamic of our audience changed from that, you know, to almost like a pop audience, and then it's sort of gone back again, and it's weird. It's very strange.
It's fascinating to me because I think you guys really were the last band to achieve great success in different pockets of the music industry. And what I mean by that is, you know, for Permission to Land, you got like Brit Awards, but also Kerrang Awards, and you know, Smash Hits would write about you, but then so would Kerrang and Metal Hammer. And I can't really think of a band since The Darkness that has managed to do that, like straddle the mainstream pop audience with that more hard rock, heavier end.
I guess it's a phenomenon. phenomenal. No, I mean, there are bands out there that do it, but like,
I guess that the industry was different then as well, wasn't it? More people were actually buying music, and you had the chance to sell a lot more albums. And
yeah, definitely. And I think I don't know, the platforms out there like these days, everything's very compartmentalized, isn't it? Really, and whereas around that time it wasn't so much, you know, it's like your press guys could get you out and get you into all sorts of different magazines. Most of those magazines aren't even there anymore. It's like, these days it's kind of like, I don't know, it just feels like a bit more, I don't know, you can't make,
it's fractured, really, isn't
broad,
it?
yeah you can't make broad strokes anymore, as far as when you're promoting something.
Did you guys go on Top of the Pops? I imagine you went on there a couple
of
times.
Loads of times. Loads of times. Yeah. I remember doing it on my birthday once, actually. That was good. It was just, what a feeling. I mean, that's just so surreal.
Yeah.
So surreal.
What age did the Wild Hearts come in? Because weren't they one of the first bands? You talked about John Mack being the first person to really book you. Weren't the Wild Hearts the first band, you know, further down the line to kind of give you guys a leg up? Didn't they take you out and open up for them on tour? What year was that? Was that before Permission to Land came out?
It was, yeah. So, I mean, that year, the year before the album came out, I mean, we toured with loads of people. But the Wild Hearts were the first, yeah. I mean, I think the first, I'm going to be wrong here, but it feels like the Roadmenders might have been the first show, or actually no, it wasn't. It was up north. I remember he was where is he from?
He's from Newcastle.
But specifically, what's the town he's from? It's next to Newcastle.
South Shields, right?
Is it? Okay. Anyway, we're up north somewhere.
Yeah.
up in the rainy bit. And he was, I think the first time I met him, he was just sat outside the venue and just signing stuff for fans and talking to them, like, for like a good, you know, 2 or 3 hours. And I was like, that is so cool. Like, just that he's always made himself really accessible to his audience. And, and he did to us as well. He was really super, super friendly and supportive and always has been. So, you know. Hats off to him.
What was their audience like? How did they take to the Darkness? Because they're a very vocal and passionate fan base. And if you win over a Wild Hearts crowd, you've then got fans for life. But I imagine coming out the way you guys would have been coming out, was it a little bit of a hard sell at first, but then did you have them by the end kind of thing? How did it work at most shows?
I don't know. To be honest, I can't remember. I was probably just trying to avoid, you know, spent the gig probably avoiding bottles of piss and stuff.
And eye contact,
exactly. Yeah, just let's get this over with. Trying to play the songs as fast as possible so that we could get out of there alive, you know. Their fan base are great. I mean, actually, you know, they've tolerated us over the years because we've we've insisted on having the Wild Hearts as our support group on so many tours.
Amazing. To pay it back.
They must be sick of us by now.
And Def Leppard as well. Were they early champions of the band?
They were.
Because Joe's another one like Ginger, isn't he? He takes a real active interest in upcoming bands. I saw a video recently where he was kind of going out of his way to name check the Struts, and he was like, you've got to check this band out, you've got to watch them. And he seems like Ginger, he's always trying to keep his eyes open for what's next and usher those bands in.
Yeah. I mean, he really championed us. He was so nice. I picked something up from him when we first played with him at some arena somewhere. The first day we got there, he kind of came into the dressing room, introduced himself, said hi, gave us a bottle of champagne to welcome us to the tour. And I was just like, this guy is the best man in the world.
Yeah.
And we've tried to follow that on. Like, so whenever we have a sport band that we don't know, we welcome them on tour with a bottle of champagne and a greeting. But
it's such a small gesture, but it means so much, doesn't it?
Yeah. Post COVID, though, it'll probably be Prosecco, actually.
Baby sham.
Maybe even Brew. Yeah. Blue Nun. Here's your Blue Nun. Now get on stage. Don't be late.
How was the Metallica tour? How did they treat you, and how did their fans? How did their fans take the darkness aesthetic?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, do you know what? Actually, one of the best reactions we ever got, I think, from an audience that wasn't ours, was from the Metallica crowd in the RDF Arena when we played with them, and I think Linkin Park.
Oh wow! What a wild bill.
You know, they Linkin Park. Apparently, Linkin Park almost got booed off. I mean, I don't want to diss anyone that you know or cast aspersions, but I remember on the day thinking because we thoroughly thought, well, this is how it's going to go. We're going to get booed off. Linkin Park going to just own it, and then Metallica will, you know, teach us all a lesson.
And
Metallica still taught everyone a lesson. Let's just put it that way. But I came off thinking that was unbelievable. You know, it was just people going mental, like massive mosh pits, and it was awesome. And I then was told that it was Phil Lynott's birthday that day.
Wow.
And I was obviously championing Thin Lizzy, so I think that's why they gave us an easy ride.
There you go. And I mean, that was your thing for years. Maybe it still is, the Thin Lizzy t-shirt. That was just kind of your uniform, wasn't it, for most of the noughties?
Yeah, it still is. I still find them in the weirdest places, you know. just everywhere.
What's your favourite Lizzy album, Dan?
That's a tough one, really. Changes all the time.
Yeah, depending on mood.
I hate to say it, but I am a bit.
The best of Thin Lizzy.
I am a bit like, well, more like, I will choose Thin Lizzy, and then I will just leave it to shuffle about.
Because there's so
much stuff. It's so broad. It's just like such a huge body of work, and it's so different. It covers so many different styles. So it really is, not in the best possible way. It's the best background music for getting on with stuff during the day. You know, if I was painting the house, which I seem to have done three times over this lockdown, I would just choose Thin Lizzy, put it on shuffle, and I'd be fine. I'd maybe have to put some Pogues on at some point.
Are you a big Pogues fan? Are you? I love the Pogues.
I'm a massive Pogues fan. Yeah.
You've been bringing in more kind of strings and things like this over the years. Like, I guess Last of Our Kind was when it started to kind of come to the forefront. But what I love about you guys is you've always had, not just between records, but within records, great variety as well. Was that always something that you wanted to set out to do, is not just have that kind of, although AC/DC are, you know, one of the best rock and roll bands ever, and I love them. They have their one lane and they stay in it, and they do that like nobody else. But you guys have never really had just one lane, have you? Even Permission to Land has, you know, many.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, sometimes it's a curse. Like because
people don't know what like a darkness single is or should be, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Nor do we anymore. It's just like for instance, like the last album, there was a very specific agenda. I was like, look, we just need to get some really immediate, straight up, 3-minute rock songs down, no mucking about.
Yeah,
and then it turned out to be like this. Just ridiculous concept album with the first single is like 5 minutes long. It's like, oh my god, I completely cocked this up. It's like halfway through the album, I was like, guys, look,
we've gone off brief here.
Yeah, look, I fucked this. All right, okay.
What a glorious mess, though. And I don't mean the album is a mess. What a mess of your initial intention.
I know. So this time, I'm going in trying to make a concept album, and hopefully we'll come out with some singles. Who knows?
Did you know, like, when you're about to release your debut album, obviously there's got to be a lot of, you know, expectation and excitement and uncertainty, but it's just such a flawless, solid gold, like banger for banger for banger of an album. When you have an album like that under your hat about to unleash into the world, are you pretty quietly confident that it's going to, you know, do even half as well as it did?
No, I mean, not really. I mean, see, here's the thing. We spent a long time making that record. Like, it may not sound like it, but See, what it was like, when I used to work for this publisher, and I was like the runner, and like used to make take copies for people and stuff like that. And I was there for quite a few years. And they had a little demo studio downstairs, which is where I met Pedro Torreira, who was the producer of that album.
Yeah.
And so we basically, before the band even formed, Pedro and I were really good mates, and we were working on stuff, and we formed a production partnership, which is what Pedro Productions is, which is the company that is credited on the
right.
the album sort of thing. So what it was, so we went into production. The first band that we decided to do was The Darkness, right? So we had this little studio set up as part of 2 Kilohertz Studio in North London. We had a little production room there. And every now and then we'd be able to grab the live room and get some drums. And then we'd bring those drums back to our tiny little studio, and then we'd overdub everything until we had the songs finished. So I was the co-producer on the tracks that we did there, right? So that was I Believe in a Thing Called Love, Love Is Only a Feeling, and Out of My Hands, I think we did, which was a B-side from somewhere. So when you listen to those tracks, like the production is completely different to the rest of the songs on the album.
I've never noticed that.
Yeah, well, next time you listen to it, you'll hear it's a game of two halves, basically. You've got
right.
Love's Only Feeling and I Believe in a Thing Called Love, which are the big productions, the kitchen sink productions, I'd say, even though there's no bottom end in the record. It's pretty full on. So we had that production room, and we were working as that production partnership for that about 6 or 7 months. So in that 6 or 7 months, we produced those three songs, right? So and during that process, yeah, I know. And during that process, I mean, that's like, you know, like I love the feeling. There's like 150 acoustic guitars, all in different tunings and stuff. I mean, that's kind of the things that I was doing back then. So Frankie at the time, rightfully, was like, and I turned into a complete control freak, the whole thing. So Frankie at the time was, look, this is not happening. No one can get a word in edgeways or make an impression, and it's taking way too long. At which point I got in the mood and said, all right, I'll quit then. I won't be producer for co-produce the rest of the album. So it just happened at that point anyway, we were starting to get some interest from those, from that EP. So like we had like Love's Only Feeling, I Believe in Thing Called Love, and Out of My Hands on a CD,
right.
The ones that I'd co-produced. And then we got to the point where there was enough interest to warrant funding recording the rest of the album. So basically we had those three songs in the can, and then we went to the chapel and we knocked out all the other songs in the space of about 6 days. So
it's from 6 months to 6 days.
Yeah. So I Believe in a Thing Called Love and Love Is Only a Feeling, 6 months. The rest of the album, 6 days. Yeah. So you can hear that. So, and I think you can hear the influence of me as producer on the I Believe in a Thing Called Love and Love Is Only a Feeling. And then you can hear what happened to the rest. So there you go.
And
it's cool. It's a good mix.
It is, and it still stands up. I listened to it like 2 days ago, and I was just like, man, song for song. And even the ones that you perhaps don't remember as well, like a song like Given Up, I mean, it's hard to imagine a band today having the balls to sing about heroin in a song in that way. And I know Justin has kind of always been very tongue-in-cheek and autobiographical with his lyrics, but... Mm. I mean, talk to me about that song, because it just seems like such a wild card song in today's world, which I guess is a sign of how much the world has changed. But it's kind of in that vein of obviously like a Mr. Brownstone song. But I just can't imagine that kind of tune being written anymore.
To be honest, like, and this is something that I think people who see the band live or actually who really get us understand. So you've got... We've got songs like I Believe in a Thing Called Love, and the video associated with that, which is utterly ludicrous, you know.
Yeah.
kids love that kind of thing, and it's just like, it's way over the top. But then on the other side, lyrically, you've got things like that song, which is closer to the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
yeah. Like,
I mean, he's talking about shooting Skag into his arm.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it'll inject it into his eye. You know, like, yeah. It's pretty full on. And I remember when we were on the South Bank show, they had a clip of us playing live, and they were running the lyrics underneath it. And it was such a weird juxtaposition. I know why they did it, because it's like you've got this guy in a like a pink leotard sort of camping about on the stage, and then the lyrics underneath it just like, oh my God, this is seriously edgy. But, you know, the objective was to write about things that you know about, and the real problem in Lowestoft for us and someone close to us was going through heroin addiction at the time, and it's very real. So, you know, it's not like it's not really a case of like you wouldn't necessarily get away with it. It's more of a case of I'm sure there are songwriters out there that are going through the same things, but probably. I don't know. Maybe I don't know. He was of the mind that he should write about things that he knows and has first-hand experience of. Otherwise, it won't be real and it won't sound real. And I think he was right.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's kind of exactly what I mean. Is that problem obviously hasn't gone away, but I just can't imagine artists today being brave enough to be that open about it because of fear of people going, "Oh, you can't have that on the record." Do you know what I mean? It just seems like a safer industry nowadays. Less dangerous.
It's difficult, though, isn't it? It's difficult, though, isn't it? Because you can kind of broadcast anything that you do.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's almost like there's almost like this thing where I could imagine if I was like a singer-songwriter or like, you know, a lyricist in a band, when it comes to lyrics, you're almost like, well, I don't know, like... It's so easy to say whatever you want and have everyone listen to it that you don't want to be seen to being trying to cause a stir or being, I don't know. It's difficult. I don't think he thought about it too much, but
I guess he had no idea how huge you were going to be either, right?
No, you know, I mean, I think being honest, we were very ambitious sonically, and you know, we always thought that we would sound better in bigger venues, but. We still didn't expect it to blow up the way that it did, you know.
Tell me about that Fame Hurricane, Dan, if you can just kind of condense it into, you know, a story or an observation, because it's next level fame, the level of attention and scrutiny and celebration and all of that at once that you guys were exposed to. How did it affect you personally?
I think one of the peaks for me was at one point... I decided that I wanted to go to the pub and see my mates, like in Camden. I think it was a locked tavern or something like that I wanted to go to. And how I had to do it, I had to have a driver and a security guard. And I was like, just wait outside. I was in that pub for about, within 5 minutes, I was taking so many pictures, signing so many autographs that I had to leave. And then go on to another pub. And then my mates would walk down the road, go to the next one. And then we'd go in, we'd do the same thing. 5 minutes, I'd have to leave. It's like, and it was like, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. I can't actually go to the pub. And then, you know, small price to pay, but I realized that that things have changed dramatically.
It gets hard to basically just do normal day-to-day things, which must be incredibly surreal. Like even going to the shops for groceries and things like this, that kind of becomes a daily challenge, right?
I never used to eat vegetables anyway, to be honest. It's like, get a load of cans of beans and a load of bread in the freezer and you're away.
So you were well stocked for the lockdown then. You were like, well, the pantry is already full.
Exactly. What lockdown?
Imagine if you'd had Deliveroo and things like that. Back in the Permission to Land Fame era, then you could have just lived it large at home. Just order everything in.
Well, that's it. Yeah. I kind of, I think when I realised that I couldn't really go out in London, that's when I moved out of London. Actually,
makes sense.
Well, there's no point to this. So I moved to Norfolk and built the studio there and kind of. You know, it's actually one of the best decisions I ever made because, you know, well documented Justin's you know, rehabilitative
downward spiral.
Rehabilitative, just say. Yeah, and like, you know, he's been sober for nearly 13 years now, and I'm really proud of him. And but you know, but it's documented that he didn't do too well through it. But the reality is, we were all just as bad as each other, and the only thing that saved me was when we get back from tour or whatever madness was happening, I would go back to my farm in Norfolk and I'd be away from everything. Whereas Justin and Edge, they were kind of just, they're always in the belly of the beast, you know? So,
no yeah, escape. It's Frankie was the first one to leave, right? Had he just had enough?
I think at the time, I mean, you know, tensions were really high. We weren't really communicating with each other. We completely lost the ability to play our instruments together. We'd completely lost the plot, basically. We really lost the plot. And under so much pressure, we needed some time to sort ourselves out, but we didn't take it. And you know, I think the only thing that maybe could have saved the band from splitting up or like self-imploding or Frank not leaving would have been time off or maybe sort of stronger management to kind of like guide us a bit, but it turns out management had gone completely off the rails as well. So it was just like we were just like, what, you know, cast adrift. But
it's the same story with almost every band in that position, isn't it? Is they get so big off that first album, nobody is there to go, maybe we should just like protect these guys and you know, maintain their sanity and mental health for a bit. Let's just take the gas off for 6 months, give it a breathe, give it a rest, and then we can ramp up again. But everybody around you wants to generate more money, don't they? So let's get them back out on tour. Let's get them in the studio. Let's get them doing this press junket. Let's get them doing this. And you're just like, oh my God, just in the fucking whirlwind of it all, like trying to keep your breath.
That's pretty much it in a nutshell. But I mean, you know, everyone wants to party with a rock and roll band. Everyone expects you to be able to just keep going, you know, and, you know, with help, we did. You know, like with
we all need a little help sometimes.
yeah, but I mean, you know, we probably had way too much help. Yeah, we say we had there was a mountain of help at hand all the time, and it just never stopped. And then, but that's what happens to those things. You know, at some point, your brain or your body or your behavior or circumstances just stop you dead in your tracks, which is, it's all good. It's all part and parcel of it, though. You know, like being a rock and roll band, you can't be a rock and roll band and not be doing these things. It's like, otherwise you're not real. You know, it's not like, you know, every band's so well behaved and so, and as you say, like everything's so compartmentalized and so risk-free and just so normalized. And it's like, where are the freaks and like the, you know, the weirdos and like the bands that are really just, you know, like look at The Who. I mean, I love the story of like the amount of instruments they trashed even before they had a record deal, like in the early days, and like they'd get all the stuff on higher purchase. It'd be gone within a week. The entire backline just smashed to pieces, and like they haven't even finished paying for it. It's like, you know, I don't know. I don't regret anything, is what I'm trying to say.
I love that. And you're exactly right. It's like if you're gonna be that kind of a band, then you have to really walk the walk as well as talk the talk.
Yeah, and live by the sword, die by the sword.
That's it. And if you get to survive, even better. And here you are all these years later. One way ticket to hell and back, you get to work with, you know, the absolute wizard, Roy Thomas Barker. Was that album a fun experience working with him, or was it kind of tainted by the chaos and the stress and the unraveling of the band? And I mean, how was it making that record, the follow-up?
I should say it's Roy Thomas Baker, but sorry.
The absolute legend that is Roy Chubby Brown. No.
The absolute legend who is Ronnie Barker. Oh yeah, brilliant! So I was basically
you were in your element learning from him, I imagine.
Yeah, because he helped me sort of design and build my studio at the time. He came to live at my farm, so when we were doing the writing and the pre-production for that album, he was there. He just came to came to live with me. Because I basically built a big live room out of the barn, one of the barns that was in my farm. And I'd yet to sort of build what would turn out to be the control room for the studio that it turned out to be. So he was so in there working with me, and he was kind of like, he kind of showed me how to EQ, you know, how to mic stuff. He taught me so much about how a good room should sound and how a room should be built. And he actually helped me build that studio. So I was very lucky in that respect. And then it just kind of went on from there, really. I was like, we worked very closely together on the album, he and I. I'd say, you know, we were pretty much inseparable for a year, I think. And even to the point where when we went to LA to mix it, I mean, just check this out. I mean, this doesn't happen anymore. We stayed at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Classic.
For, I think, 2 months. I mean, can you believe it? I mean, my extras bill was 11 grand.
Just living on room service all day, yeah.
Just the extras, yeah. So anyway, so vulgar, isn't it? It's just gross.
No, it was that time. It was that time. And that money was there in abundance then, wasn't it? You weren't counting the receipts. Yeah, well, that wasn't your job.
Do you know what? The reality is that you know, it was, well, we didn't really see any money from the first record, unbelievably, because...
What, even after quadruple platinum sales?
No, because
that's why the industry bombed, isn't it?
Well, I think it's more of a case of
streaming. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there is that, but the reason why we didn't see any money more, you know, was because the label were investing at our expense in huge ad campaigns across the world, and so. You know, it swings and roundabouts. You know, they're investing heavily in the record, and you make money in other ways. So it's always a bit of give and take. So. And anyway, so but at that point, we were like, well, we're not making any money from selling these records. Let's try and spend as much money of the record labels as we can while we make this album.
Brilliant.
We're never going to fucking see any money anyway. So that's why where we went out of our way to. And I think we got it to about a million in the end, making that album.
How do you feel about it now? How do you feel about it now?
I know
looking
that
back?
Because, well, 10 years later, the fucking thing still hasn't recouped, has it? So, but it's almost there, I think. So, I don't know. So I feel good and bad about it.
What about the material and the songs and the production and the overall just flow of the record?
You know, here's the thing: we were not in a good place. You know, like we weren't playing together as a band. It was like, it's amazing. Like, we toured so much, but if you just tour and don't write and rehearse, and actually you forget what you actually sound like. And that sounds stupid, but like you can become pretty loose. I think it's not like, I don't think you actually. Sometimes get better and better. That like the more you play live, sometimes you need to bring it back and write new stuff and listen to each other.
Well, it's because of the chemistry, right? It's the chemistry and the human element of being in a band with a specific mix of individuals.
Yeah. Well, we just refused to rehearse. By the end of it, we just wouldn't even sound check. We'd rather get over the hangover and then just go and play and not worry about sound check. So. It was just, we'd just forgotten what it was like to play together and make that sound together. So even when we were writing the album, we still weren't doing that. It was kind of like electronic drums, and it was all a bit convoluted. So the big mistake we made was when they're just saying, right, let's go in the studio and record it. And I'd say that was a mistake, because what we should have done is gone into like rehearsal mode and done proper pre-production, and then we would have realized, oh fuck, none of us can play together anymore, and we would develop that. We've made their song sound a bit more like a band, because what happened is we went into the studio and then Roy and I realized, oh shit, we've got a problem here. You know, everyone's forgotten how to play their instruments, so we kind of had to like kind of create the drum tracks from pretty much nothing. And Frankie wasn't even there, and I played bass on it, and it was all very weird, and no one was really in the studio at the same time. It was just weird. It was So for me, that was just one massive experiment in production and techniques and stuff like that, and it gave me a real insight to all that. But it wasn't the album that it probably could have been. But then, you know what? It's just it is what it is. And in a weird way, I'm kind of proud of it as well, because I know what the band were going through. I think actually it's a miracle we actually made anything at that period of time. It's amazing we were still together by the end of that, making that album.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The peak for me in the middle of the record is that 3-song run of Hazel Eyes Bold Girlfriend. I love that. Like right in the middle there, that trilogy is just, that's my jam spot right there.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like,
which ones do you play off it still live? Obviously One Way, but any other tracks get regular outings still?
Well, I mean, randomly, we've brought out Hazel Eyes every now and then. We've had a lot of requests for Bald, actually.
Bald's great.
And English Country Garden, we revisited when Rufus joined the band. And he really, I mean, right up his street, you know. And I actually really, you know, no regrets or anything, but if we'd have had Rufus on that album, my God. It could have been an entirely different story, because of the way, if you ever hear, I don't know, maybe it was on the Pinewood Smile tour, we were playing in English Country Garden with Rufus on it. It's like a whole different ball game. It's just ferocious. So anyway,
like obviously when you reform, you and Justin and Frankie are on board, and then after the record that you make with Ed, he leaves, and I loved. As just not just a comeback record, but just as a record, still now Hotcakes, such a good album. I was working on Kerrang at the time; that would have been when I first met you guys. And just getting to play like Nothing's Going to Stop Us and Every Inch of You and Everybody Have a Good Time, and even like some of the album songs that weren't singles, like Keep Me Hanging On, She's Just a Girl, Eddie, amazing, amazing record. And then you kind of get Emily in. Is it after that? And then you settle with Rufus, and I mean, he is just the perfect drummer for your band, isn't he? And it seems like since he's joined, you've just gone from strength to strength as a musical outfit, but also as just a group of individuals. And every time I see you and have encounters with you, you see you're like a band that are all happy, and the chemistry is all there, and it's a beautiful thing to see.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, he's just like, we're very lucky, you know. Like, I can't imagine anyone else really being in the band. It's like it really is like a shot in the arm. It's kind of, it's, you know, I think I was saying about like being a band again, it kind of, when he joined, it's the first time it really felt like real again.
Yeah
As opposed, you know, sort of back, coming back to like the first album kind of feeling that we had, where you know, we really felt like a band, like a togetherness. And
yeah, I guess when you reformed, you wanted that original lineup, right? Because it had to be at least tried. But then, assumingly, Ed just didn't want to tour, right? He was just done with being in like a working band.
When it doesn't work out, it's always really sort of sad with bands because you go through so much together. It's like it's like being in the army together or something, I'd imagine. You know, you go through these really like crazy experiences that other people probably don't really could never even really imagine how extreme those things are. So, you know, that why we wanted to give it a go is because we wanted to see whether it was like that, and it wasn't really. It's difficult with when people leave bands. It's like, you know, I would love to go into depth as to why it didn't work out with Ed, but wouldn't really be fair on Ed, and you know, he's a good mate and stuff. So
no, it's all good, mate.
And he's a great drummer, and actually very, you know, in many ways, like is as rock and roll as Rufus. but the thing about Rufus is he just doesn't care. Like, it's just crazy. You see massive shows, and I'll be pacing about, like, and it's like, I don't know. He'd just be pissing about before we. He's like very much like Justin.
Yeah.
Like those two would be pissing about, like right up to the point they go on stage, and I'm like, guys, can we just focus? can we not be throwing that around? Can you? So it just made things really fun again, basically.
And the dynamic's so great. Like, how did you and Frankie reconnect? Did you stay in touch as friends after he left the band, or was there a period of estrangement? And if so, like, how did he come back into the fold? How did you reconnect with him?
Well, we were all estranged really from each other.
Even you and Justin, you know, during that time.
Yeah, Justin and I, Frankie and I, none of us were talking to each other. It was a complete and utter mess. You know, and even at that point, I'd sacked Ed from Stone Gods. So right. It was like it was all just a complete mess. And it all kind of came back together again through Justin and I. I don't know, almost like bumping into each other, really.
Literally by accident.
Well,
you just had to address the situation. Like, oh.
Yeah, it was just like one of those things where, I can't even remember. It was like I was literally walking past his house in London, and I knew where he lived at the time. And I was like, "This is just stupid. I can't walk past here."
Yeah.
So I just bailed him up, and he was like, "Yeah, come around." And then we were like playing computer games within 20 minutes, and then within an hour we were writing a song. You know, because it's like that's what we always used to do. You know, and then it just sort of snowballed from there.
Did the old friendships come back pretty soon? Like, as soon as you're playing together again, is it like nothing had happened and everything's forgotten and forgiven? And
yeah, I mean, I guess the day one of getting back together, all of us getting back together, you know, pre hotcakes or whatever, was weird. And, you know, day one of rehearsals, but it felt good. It felt exciting. You know, it did feel like we're, you know, back to normal again. I mean, that in that whole period we were rehearsing up in Lowestoft, and it's quite a bleak time of year, so it was like it really was like starting from scratch.
How important is humor, Dan? Because I know you guys not only have it in your music, but you're just incredibly funny individuals. Frankie's just the king of the kind of dry one-liners. You and Justin just have a brilliant comic rapport. Is that, would you say, to anybody listening to this trying to gain an insight into things that help you through these hurdles in relationships, is humor and the ability to laugh the ridiculous off, has that played, do you think, a significant role in the healing of this band?
Yeah, definitely. You know, you can't take yourself too seriously, and people change, you know. It's like no one's perfect. It's like, you know, it's like, this is why, like, it's hard to keep a marriage together, isn't it? It's like, because people actually change. And it's not like you can do anything about it sometimes, but one thing you've got to retain is the ability to laugh at yourself and actually look at how much you've changed. You know, see yourself from someone else's point of view, really. You know, I used to take myself way too seriously, you know, like, and I had a good friend of mine almost like beat that out of me, you know. And, you know, when the band split up and stuff, it was like, I just took everything way too seriously. And certain friends was like, how can I say it? Like, knocked it out of me.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, well, do you know what? Like, then, taught me to not take myself seriously and laugh at myself. And then at which point I found the whole thing hilarious, you know. I realized that I hadn't been through like this horrible experience. I was like, actually, no, this is just brilliant. This is just stuff to tell your grandkids about and just be thankful that you had the opportunity to do it in the first place.
Oh, dude, you guys have had such an amazing life and so many amazing opportunities and experiences. One of which, for me, I'd love to hear about, just for the kind of reason that it must have been a surprising offer and actually a brilliant experience. I'm sure the Lady Gaga tour, when you get back together, and she, I know, is a huge fan of rock and roll. I've got a clip of her on this like Australian radio station talking about how much she loves Airborne. And I know they're good pals of yours from touring with them with Stone Gods. How was the Gaga tour?
It was brilliant. Yeah, she was really nice as well. It was cool. I mean, it's like we knew we weren't really going to expect much from the audience, as far as being a support band goes. But that kind of all changed when we got to South America. It was like doing headline shows, really.
They're ready to party, were they?
Oh my God, it was unbelievable. It's such a great time. So it was worth it alone for the, you know, for the sort of South American shows and the experience of going there. And it was a crazy thing, really, because the label were like not happy that we went on that tour, because it meant that we couldn't promote the album in a normal way. You know, like we couldn't
do
a UK tour. The UK tour had to be put on hold for about a year.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like a year after the album came out. We toured UK and Europe, and so we did this enormous tour, but it sunk the album, but it was a great experience. I mean, I got to swim with sharks in South Africa. I've been, you know, all over South America. It was just, you know, Russia, all these places I've never been to before. And the way the production was so massive that you could only do one show every 3 days. So we play for half an hour and then that's 3 days off.
Oh, mate. And it was just almost like a kind of a bonding experience for you guys as a band, just to travel the world and get up to adventures.
Much. Yeah, I mean, you know, we just played a lot of tennis. And that sounds like a really posh sport, but it's actually, it was one of those weird things where, like, our guitar techs at the time were really into tennis, and Justin was into tennis, and Frankie was. So I was like, okay, well, I'll join in. And then, so it just, we were playing tennis for like 4 hours a day.
we
go out and play. We might play in these most random, we find like a clay court in the middle of San Juan or whatever. And, you know, it's just crazy, like playing in 40 degree heat. I remember most about that tour was the tennis, really.
It's amazing that you did it as well, because I know so many bands would have just been too cool for school and like, I'm not doing that. Another one's Ed Sheeran that springs to mind. And again, it's just an opportunity. You guys are such an arena fit band. The songs are fit for huge rooms. You're obviously amazing performers. You're no stranger to that environment. And to get to, I think, you know, go in front of crowds which aren't your own and introduce the band still at this stage, all these years later, to new ears. Of course, that's an opportunity that for me would be a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter who it is. Like, if you get asked if you want to play in front of 80,000 people, you're going to say yes. But that's, you know, playing with Ed was just awesome. You know, again, there's another guy. It's just like, you can't believe how sort of affable and like nice these people are. Like, you just, it's just crazy. I'm sure we weren't that nice when we were that famous. Not that we ever were, actually. maybe, Maybe that's why we didn't maintain it.
They're definitely not hoofing rails of cocaine and throwing their career away then. They're just like, down to earth people.
I remember when the night of the Brit Awards, the night before the Brit Awards, I thought it was a really good idea to get really, really hammered. And so the day of the Brit Awards, I was just, hungover like a bastard. And to the point where when we went down to Earl's Court, wherever it was, because we played live as well. So, quite a big deal, playing like four songs live in front of about a billion people or whatever. And there I'm so hungover. I've made a bed underneath the table in the dressing room where the rider is.
Yeah.
So if anyone wanted to get hold of me, there was like just this notice saying, "Dan's under here." I'm just desperately trying to sleep. Funny enough, actually, the thing that got me through that was a sports massage, because it was like coming close to the rehearsal time, and I said to our tour manager, Moz, I was like, "Moz, I'm in real trouble here. This is a real creeper." And he got this sports masseuse in, and he gave me this. I said, "Look, I've got a really bad hangover, and I've got to play live and do this whole Brits thing tonight." And so she dug into the back of my neck and really worked really hard to the point where I thought I was going to be sick at one point. And then I came out of that. Not only had the hangover completely disappeared, I wasn't even remotely nervous for the whole night. It was just everything just gone. It was incredible.
A complete reset.
The power of it just shows you the power of massages and stuff like that.
Physiotherapy.
I've desperately been trying to massage my hangovers out myself, but I just can't seem to get in there.
What's your favorite? Have you got any good celebrity party stories, Dan? Did you get up to mischief with any high-profile hellraisers in that time? Or was that more
probably
Justin's thing?
Well, I don't know. It's across the board, really. I mean, a festival's always fun.
Yeah,
I remember winding up in a festival in Sweden, where I was slow dancing with the Pet Shop Boys and doing shots with Kings of Leon at the same time.
Brilliant!
That was a good night.
Hey, when's the documentary coming out? Because I remember at the Dark Nestival thing we did, you had like a good trailer for that, which was like a 5-10 minute long sample of what the finished film was going to be like. That was 4 years ago, and there's some amazing celebrities in that talking about the band and their memories of them. Is that still a project that is going to see the light of day? What's going on with it?
Well, apparently so. I mean, like Simon Emmett, he texted me yesterday. I need to get back to him, saying that he's got an edit that he thinks looks really great. So he's working on it. I mean, this is the thing. Maybe it's the sort of thing that, lockdown has maybe pushed it forward, but
there you go.
I will chase that up today. I mean, it's one of those things where I really want everyone to see it, and then also I don't, because it's, it's real.
Yeah.
And it's like,
as you say, you might have no regrets, but there's still the element of shame when some of those stories are resurfaced, right?
Well,
and you're like, God.
Well, it's not that. It's more about, like, I mean, he's just followed us through. I mean, he's got 6 years worth of footage from like playing in like, campsites in Wales, Butlins in Wales, to like pubs in Ireland, to like, the Roundhouse in London, and playing to 100,000 people in Italy.
And Reading and Leeds and all that stuff.
We just changed so much. I really feel like we've been ramping up to the point where we are now, where it's going really well, but the film is not necessarily about that. It's more like the journey. So, so in a way, I'm kind of like, I'm hoping it'll end up on a high, so we'll see. But, but listen, Simon Emmett, who's making it, is just a brilliant filmmaker.
It looked really good, what I saw. And there was, I think Lily Allen was in one segment. There was all kinds of people in it talking about how much they love the band. And it had a great look to it. I don't think I saw any of the archive footage in the bit that I saw, but the presentation of it looked really slick. And it's an amazing story, because, as you say, like, you guys could have just disappeared after that breakup and never come back. But not only to come back, but to come back and continue to put out consistent quality records every couple of years and just continue to grow and grow and grow. And the shows continue to get bigger. I couldn't get into your Christmas show last year for love nor money. I was hitting up your agent, the booker, your publicist. I was trying to get in from every angle, and it was like the hottest ticket in town. And you did two nights there as well, right? Did you at the Roundhouse? Or was it just the one? But either way, I definitely couldn't get in.
Yeah,
I was devastated.
Well, you got my number now.
But was that a good one? Was that a good way to end last year? Because it was a huge tour you did.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was just so great. We were trying to do. We played the whole of that album on that tour.
Yeah,
which was quite adventurous, and it was all like kind of. It was all. But we had a video made for every song, and massive screens, and it was just it was the biggest production we've done in like a decade or whatever. And it was a real challenge as well, because it's nothing's on click track, and getting video to run to a band that are playing live with no click tracks that just kind of flows
with synced visuals
line
as well. Yeah,
nightmare.
Yeah.
So it was just nice. It was a risk, really, to kind of do that, but it really paid off, because it's sort of people really, really loved the first half, and then they got the greatest hits on the second half, and it was cool. Yeah, it's like and it was sold out pretty much the whole tour. So things are on the up.
Yes,
well, I've been on that for a while, actually.
And you've had some amazing, kind of big rock and roll shows as well. Guns N' Roses, Alice Cooper, or the Hollywood Vampires. Was it Hollywood Vampires you did?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was cool. The Guns N' Roses thing was just outrageous. I mean,
was that a real bucket list moment for you?
Well, it was just that. I think we played at Imola Racetrack, and there were 130,000 people there. It's like just wild. And it went really well. This is just amazing. We've played with Guns N' Roses quite a few times in the past, so various incarnations of.
Was this the first time playing with Axl and Duff and Slash together?
Yeah, it was, yeah. And, it was really cool.
Did they sound good? Were they on point?
They did. They did. Really good, actually. Yeah, I was really, not surprised, but I was surprised at how good Axl sounded, actually.
I saw him with AC/DC, and he was amazing doing that. They brought out a load of old Bon Scott songs that I'd never seen them done before.
Oh, amazing.
He was bang on time, and he really delivered. He really silenced the critics on that one. I think that was a big part of the kind of Guns N' Roses healing process and reunion as well. And again, it's nice to see, because like you guys, people want to see those songs, but they want to see those players on stage again, and they want to see those guys happy in each other's company. And
because
you can tell, can't you, when a band's on stage and they fucking hate each other? You can just see, 100%. You can see the tension from the back of the arena.
I know. They're just, so, I mean, I think it's going to be, when we come out of all this bollocks, basically, it's going to be, live music's going to be just, if there are any venues left.
Venues left, it's going to be incredible. Booming, isn't it? Not only are just everybody going to be wanting to play, but everybody's going to be wanting to see shows as well. Have you considered the live stream thing? Because here's an idea for you, Dan. Forget Easter's cancelled. Christmas is saved. Christmas live stream with the Christmas live stream with the darkness.
Well, all I'm going to say is that there are discussions in the pipeline. There are discussions.
There are.
They're not in the pipeline. the discussions aren't in the pipeline. The discussions are out of the pipeline and are being had.
Amazing. Well, we'll leave that there then. And finally, can you tell us anything about the upcoming beer release with Signature Brew? Because I saw you just visited the studio probably yesterday, or the day before?
Well, because you are all over it. Yeah, yeah.
I'm astute, mate, if nothing else.
We're going to do something with them, and it may or may not be out before Christmas, but we're hoping it will be.
Lovely.
And it may or may not be a Christmas ale. Who knows?
There we go. I look forward.
It's going to be awesome, though.
I look forward to sampling whatever delicious beverage you're concocting, and they're good.
That's on my bucket list. It really is. You know, like you have the opportunity to actually develop it. You know, it's not like we're just whacking a name on a beer. I've been there, and with the head brewers doing taste tests and actually getting it together, it's going to be mega exciting. Mega excited about that.
Love it, dude. Well, listen, mate, it's been really nice catching up and having a chat, and it was nice to to reconnect after 4 years. And hopefully the next time we do have a chat will be in real life, Dan. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It'll be when you're trying to get into another sold out gig.
Please, Dan. I've asked everyone. It's the hottest ticket in town. Mate, so nice chatting, and we look forward to the return of live music and the next Live Darkness show, whenever that may be. Take care, man. Thanks for giving up your time.
Cheers
Dan.
Thanks, Matt.